From the Sky News Centre at 6. Some shoppers are being left stranded at tills as many Visa card payments are currently failing across the UK and elsewhere in Europe. Businesses are unable to process transactions at the moment. The firm says it's experiencing a service disruption and is investigating. Banking and finance expert Professor Peter Hahn has this advice.
It's a little late for people who are suffering, but in today's world with cyber risks, everyone really needs two means. You should always be carrying two means to make a payment. It almost means you should have two bank accounts. Cyber risk can happen really anywhere.
The EU Trade Commissioner says Donald Trump's tariffs are further weakening transatlantic relations. He slapped extra charges on steel and aluminium imported from the European Union, Canada and Mexico in a move to help protect American companies. The EU is now drawing up a list of US products it's going to put taxes on in retaliation. International Trade Secretary Liam Fox says there's another immediate priority.
We will need to see safeguard measures put in place to stop any steel that is diverted away from the US market surging into the European and UK markets to the detriment of our own production.
Northern Rail has announced it's removing 165 trains per day until the end of July. The train operator says it's axing 6% of its services to try to improve reliability after new timetables introduced nearly 2 weeks ago caused major disruption. Holborn Underground Station is being reopened in London after reports of a man with a knife on one of the carriages. Specialist officers went to the scene. One man's been arrested. They found two knives. 800 jobs are at risk at Mothercare. The retailer struck a deal with creditors that means it'll shut 50 loss-making stores. And in sport, England's cricketers are trying to establish a lead in their first innings against Pakistan at Headingley. They bowled the visitors out for just 174 and a short time ago were 81 for one. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
BCFM 93.2, 7 till 9, hour 1. Hot releases, brand new promos in the mix. You get me?
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Cabinet Member for Transport and Connectivity and Labour Councillor for Eastfield, Mukhvari Threlfall. Also, Lib Dem Councillor for Central, Mark Wright. Not Central, sorry. Hot Wells and Harbourside. Oops. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, we preview next week's secret Rulers of the NATO Countries annual Bilderberg meeting. The high priests of globalisation, some call them, and the creators of the EU, according to people who've attended the meetings. That is the West's secret Kingmakers Conference next week in Turin, in Italy. Yes, Italy. Where a bankster or banker or Goldman Sachs inspired pro-Euro, pro-EU technocrat government's just been appointed. That's right, appointed, not elected, just like the EU Commission. But more to the point, this flies in the face of what the Italian people voted for back in March. Will Theresa May's replacement be invited to the meeting of the Kingmakers next week? Also, the Babchenko resurrection. He's a Ukrainian anti-Putin journalist, but that died. Well, he was murdered, but he wasn't. And also the political earthquakes in Spain and Italy. Tariff boy Trump calls President Assad an animal as Assad tells the Americans to get out of his country or else. And he's gone but not forgotten. The plucky Conservative MP for Huddersfield in the 1980s was receiving threatening phone calls and had his home burgled twice. Just after Jeffrey Dickens famously handed a dossier after dossier about VI paedophiles to the then Home Secretary Leon Britton, who then lost them. A hunt for them, ordered by the then Home Secretary Theresa May in 2014, came up with nothing, raising further questions about whether the Home Office is the right body to manage the increasingly limited child sex abuse inquiry. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, dry and mild this weekend, warm Saturday and hot on Sunday. Dry, less and less cloud actually going over the weekend. Next week, around 21 Celsius during the week. Dry, mostly sunny next weekend. It's the 9th and 10th of June. Inching up a little, or down a little actually, from 21. 20 Celsius next weekend. Dry again. Proper June weather actually into the week after next. That was the Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Cabinet Member for Transport and Connectivity, Vari Threlfall. Hi, Vari. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
How long have you been doing this job for in the Cabinet now?
So it's probably about 9 months. So I started in August 2017.
Transport, I think we all know, is Metro Bus at the moment. But what is connectivity?
Connectivity. It's essentially part of my title looking at kind of the wider scope around smart cities. So one of our big ambitions is certainly around the smart cities agenda. We've got the Smart Operations Centre, which is actually quite, you know, revolutionary in terms of our approach to traffic management.
The Smart Operations Centre. I better write that down. I'm afraid every time someone says smart this, smart that, yeah, I start thinking, actually, maybe it's not so smart. Maybe it's going to go wrong. Maybe it's hackable. And maybe my data is being harvested using it. So what is a smart city?
So I'm not sure how many people would want to hack gully sensors. So that's essentially looking at flooding on roads. So it's using technology to improve actually how we maintain our highways, thinking about asset life cycles, also how we manage our traffic.
Okay, so was that why there was all flooding all down the White Ladies Road last weekend?
Exactly. So one of the interesting things we're exploring at the moment is actually how we can prevent that be really responsive to things like blocks.
So the idea is you press a button and the water goes down a different chute somewhere, does it?
No, so the idea is that rather than having individuals coming out and checking each individual gully, you would be able to kind of find out which gullies were blocked by a sensor within the gully.
Okay. Mm. Yeah. Does it work? Because it didn't work last weekend.
Well, it's not operational yet. So what I was using that as an example of things we'd like might want to explore as part of smart cities.
Have you got a smart meter then?
No, I don't know. Mark, is that the energy?
Mark, yeah. Right. This is for your electricity. There's a massive amount of government money being put behind trying to get us to get smart.
Yeah, it's
meters.
Mandatory now, I think.
I'm afraid in our house, in our family, companies. And the various sort of branches of the family are totally dead against it. And I think you could even imagine sort of nailing a clamp on your existing meter so no one can come in and change it. But what do you make of this smart technology, smart cities, Mark?
What Vari's just described sounds like a good idea. I mean, my opinion of the word smart is that it just means new. It doesn't usually mean smart at all. I mean, but using real-time data from measuring devices in order to, you know, in order to make systems more responsive is always a good idea. I mean, clearly the way the traffic system works in Bristol now, you know, with real-time sensing in order to change the way the traffic lights are phased and things like that. If, you know, when that goes down, the whole city grinds to a halt immediately, pretty much. So you can tell how dependent we are on some systems like that.
We just had that story in the news at the top of the hour there. The visa payment disruption hits Europe. I mean, suddenly all these people, like Vari, just before we came in here, you were saying, oh, I don't use cash at all. I just use my card for everything. Suddenly, a little thing like that, and you're stuck.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, clearly we are loading more and more dependency on top of computers. I mean, I think everybody realizes that, and that obviously makes us more and more vulnerable to computers going down. I mean, society has always done this kind of thing, though. There was an interesting program on last night. Bettany Hughes and Rakshaw Dave from the archaeology program looking at Pompeii. Pompeii was entirely dependent on lead piped in water from its aqueduct, and they were recording that during the earthquakes the aqueduct had broken, the water dried up, and Pompeii overnight became basically uninhabitable because there was no water there. The entire city depended on the piped in water. So this is a facet of civilization.
I mean, isn't Bristol similar today? I mean, surely, I mean, I know certainly in medieval times it was dependent on the conduits, but there was more than one at least coming into the city centre. centre. In fact, that Fawcett down by I can't think, is it St John's Church by the wall there? Actually, was when I first arrived in Bristol in the 1990s, it was going right up until about 2010 or so, when Bristol Water went and did some works, and then it conked out. It's never been going since. But I mean, are we safe here with our water supply?
Well, I think Bristol actually has several sources. Most of the north of the city, I think, comes from canal systems north of the city. The south of the city comes from Tew Valley Lake. But I think that the water company builds in multiple redundancy in terms of routes. So no single route, other than the dam at Tew Valley being blown.
I think we better drag them in and demand an answer.
Yeah, indeed. So, I mean, the problem they had at Pompeii was that the entire city was dependent on the one aqueduct. And likewise, if you make your entire finance system dependent on one visa thing and that goes down, then you're in trouble. So the trick to future-proofing is to imagine failures and to build in multiple redundancies.
Martin, isn't there actually a case for something like Visa to be government-run and government-right? But it's not, is it? It's run by the banks,
well,
privately.
Well, the SWIFT payment system has become a political football. And the Chinese and the Russians are trying to develop their own alternative.
That's used for bank transfers around the world.
Yeah, they're trying to develop their own alternative system because they can be shut out of it. Because the multinationals which run it are aligned with Western governments.
So who would decide if someone is shut out of the smart payment system, SWIFT payment? Is that government or a bank?
Well, it's a moot point who actually makes the decisions with it. But they've threatened to cut Iran, Russia and China out of the system, and therefore they've taken note of that, and they're trying to make sure that their systems are such that they can't be cut out of it.
Don't try your Visa card in Iran, folks. I mean, probably won't go down very well. Anyway, so Vari Metro Bus, that's one of the main reasons I called you, to try and get you in, because apparently it started on Wednesday. Have you been on
Tuesday?
Oh, was it?
Yes,
okay.
Yes. Sorry, Tuesday. Yes. Yeah. So it's actually a route. So my day job, I kind of work up at the University of the West of England. So actually, it's a route that I use.
Gosh. So you're who are actually using it every
the
day.
Commuter. So it's been really great, actually. So since the launch on Tuesday morning, actually, we had about 1,500 passengers use the service. Obviously, it's free for the first 2 weeks. And it certainly makes a difference in the morning. And the afternoon, so the evening peak, because the avoidance of for instance, the 2+ lane at Junction 1, which gets quite loaded with traffic, and the M32, obviously, bus lane that has been used for the last few months, is making a real difference.
These just look like kind of ordinary buses with a kind of weird wheel that goes sideways. I mean, you know, it is just a bus, really, isn't it?
Yeah, they are buses, absolutely, yeah. And we've the investment was in bus infrastructure. But the key thing here is, and the game changer, is the approach to the infrastructure. So looking at identifying where new developments were coming through and actually connecting them into employment areas, and also the approach to the quality bus standards. So one of the key things about Metrobus is that they're much better quality of a bus than kind of your standard background bus network.
Very comfortable.
So, yep, and it's a game changer in terms of, you know, the emission standards. They've got Wi-Fi, electric charging points, although I did find I wasn't able to charge my phone on the bus because it was a 10-minute journey. I was used to having a 30-minute journey, so I was really surprised it's only a 40% battery by the time I got to work.
Mark, I know you've got some questions about what's happened with Metrobus, because it's not what has been delivered this week is not actually what was promised originally, is it?
No, not really. I mean, clearly the original plan was, first of all, to deliver the Ashton Vale to City Centre and Temple Meads route first. That was delayed and delayed and delayed, and eventually it came out quite recently that the problem that's been causing the delay is that the guide rail is slightly in the wrong place, perhaps by, you know, as little as an inch or something like that, which is obviously extremely disappointing. I'm not going to criticise Vari for that, because I think that's probably a constructor incompetence from among the contractors. I do regret, though, that when I was asking the council month after month, why is it being delayed, what's going on, because most of that route goes through my ward, that they were stringing me along and telling me this and telling me that, and basically feeding us lines and maybe lies is the right word. It was, for a long time, it was all about the ticketing and all this kind of stuff. So I think that's a real regret. The other issues, I think, are that we've had at the last minute this, you know, the South Bristol Link Road route has been dropped. And we've been told by First Bus, at least, that this route was always an aspiration. And it was certainly not an aspiration when we were running the council up to 2012. It was an integral part of the system.
Well, certainly, as I remember, it wasn't under George. It was part of the network.
No, indeed. I mean, we would have given George a kicking if we had known that he had dropped it as down to just an aspiration. It's an important route because the whole point of that route was to link the Hengrove site, which is to be, you know, a first-class business and residential site, to link that potentially to the airport, so as to allow international business to come in and be served via the airport. So at the moment, there is no easy route from South Bristol to the airport, if you're at Hengrove rather. That route allows you to get to the airport with just a simple change at the roundabout on the A38. And now there's no sign of that route now. And actually, that's a real problem, and it's a real blow for South Bristol. I mean, I would be interested in Vari's explanation of that. But I mean, First have now come forward and they've said that the reason is because they don't want to harm their other routes, which you can understand from their point of view. But again, everybody knew that this was going to be a problem the moment First got the contract to do Metrobus, whilst also being the main current bus provider in Bristol. We all knew that there was potential for conflict of interest and that First would try to avoid harming their old routes, and that might compromise some of the new routes.
I suppose the question, Vari, is to you, is how tough were you with First Bus?
No, I just need to clarify something. So Metrobus isn't just a bus, it's about delivery of infrastructure. And the council, it was a multi-agency, so obviously your question should have been going to the Metrobus team, the West of England Metrobus team, but it was a multi-agency project. Now, once Metrobus was delivered, as in the city centre, the bridges, the bus lanes, the other infrastructure, we set a quality bus standard for use of that infrastructure. Now, any bus company, any operator can opt to run Metrobus. This isn't something that's contracted, it's 100% commercial. And so what First have done is they've said we will take on the M1, M2 and M3 routes because they take 95% of the loadings, and we feel that because we operate within a private bus market, which is in itself a challenge and something that we should be having a conversation and debate around, they've said we're taking on these three because we see them as being commercially viable. Now, I've been working very closely with Karen Smith, the MP for Bristol South, on looking at how we can get an operator in to run the South Bristol Link route. Because those conversations are still ongoing. They haven't been dropped. They aren't missing. The map that was produced was the operator map. So it was a First Bus map showing the M1, M2 and M3. So the routes that they've chosen to kind of go forward with. And I think that's really important, really crucial, that these aren't services that we're subsidising. These aren't, we have as a council very little control since 1986 due to the 1985 Transport Act around bus services. However, with the combined authority, new bus powers have come forward, which we should be exploring. We should be having that conversation. And I am at the moment working with my colleagues in the other local authorities around the development of a joint bus strategy explore how those powers can be utilised.
I mean, Mark's point stands surely that there's actually a conflict of interest here. You've got a new operator coming in that's actually competing with themselves. They don't want to be competing with themselves. They'd rather make that money on the existing buses than build a whole nother run a whole nother system, which is going to take passengers away from their existing
and
bus.
That's the crux of, you know, operating within private bus markets. That, I mean, fundamentally, public transport, you know, we really need to be thinking about that and having that debate. But the other thing to say, though, is that the South Bristol Link route will be used in September by the airport bus. So there will be two airport flyer services, as well as the one, I think, that comes from Bath, but I might be wrong on that, so don't quote me on that one. We'll be using that service. So if the question is around access to the airport, certainly airport services will be using that route.
But that's not a route from Hengrove, though, is it? That's a route down from the airport to Ashton Vale, which is fine, and that'll be great. It'll be a quick journey from the airport to Temple Meads via the Ashton Vale route, but that's not a route from Hengrove to the airport.
No, and as I said, I'm having ongoing conversations, you know, around that specific
route. Okay, there's another thing B5 got really about First Bus doing this, and that is that they were responsible for the network in Croydon, where there was a crash a couple of years ago, where the drivers had been reporting to the operators, First Bus, that a section of the line was dangerous, that they'd had some near misses, and that they thought that something needed to be done to make sure that it wasn't possible to have a crash. And First Group, for whatever reason, decided to do nothing about it. And then there was a crash. I think something like 7 people died on their tram. Now, obviously, this is something slightly different to a tram, but are they... I mean, surely, you know, after a crash like that, Mark, I'll ask you first, surely, you know, First Bus shouldn't even be in the running.
I can't say I'm aware of that particular incident, but First Bus, I don't think First Bus are good for Bristol, to be perfectly honest. I mean, they've taken complete control of all the system, and we know that they're very, very aggressive to any other bus company that comes in and tries to run anything on any.
No, well, how do you mean aggressive? I mean, you know, surely another bus company can run a bus. Nothing First Bus
but
can
they
do
will,
about it.
First Bus are the first to say that such and such route is, you know, is unviable if they're not making enough money on it. But we know what they did some years ago when some other buses came in and tried to run along the route number one. Is that they deliberately dropped the cost of the route number one, and then they ran buses just ahead of the schedule of the buses for the new company in a deliberate attempt to put that company out of business. And then, of course, as soon as that company was out of business, the bus frequency that they put on goes back down and the prices go back up.
But that's just making money. That's what businesses do.
Well, yes, if you describe doing business as deliberately trying to bankrupt all of your competitors, which is, you know, which is the modus operandi of some companies, Microsoft, IBM, we can think of several of them, but we don't have to pretend that that is good for the public or good for the city. And First have been like this for a very long time. I mean, I understand that they were the only people that came forward in order to run Metrobus, which is a great shame. The reality is, I think we want to be looking constantly to try and get some other people in. Ideally, we do not want First running these Metrobus routes because they're not going to give us best value out of the investment that's been put into the infrastructure. They're not going to give us the best competition between the Metrobus routes and the existing routes, which is what we want if we want to see all of the transport networks improve due to competition.
Just looked that up, and it's the Croydon tram crash was in November 2016, and I was right, there were 7 deaths, and the operators were First Bus, no, First Group. The other thing is that this, Martin Summers, maybe you can come in here, because First Group are an American company. They have massive investments, and actually what they nearly went bankrupt because they weren't able to repay their debts. So effectively, when we're buying our ticket, obviously we're paying for a service, but at the top end of that ticket price is a little bit being creamed off just to service First Group's massive debt, and effectively we're just paying their debts off for them.
Well, I think the fundamental point as made by Vari is that these things shouldn't be run in the private sector at all, and they weren't before like the 1980s, and when we bring about more competition, the structure of this market and the technologies involved don't lead to a competitive market. That's why these infrastructural networks were nationalised or municipalised in the first place.
So Vari,
in London, when Ken Livingstone was first elected, that's exactly what they were trying to do. Is he used the fact that it was a public system to, you know, to boost externalities, positive externalities, and so on, and run it on a planned basis.
Kind of what is that? Competition, a positive externality. What they were trying to do was actually to make the entire public transport in London free, paid for out of the rates, and now of course the rates.
The positive externalities is then the business and social activities in the city become much more viable. In Seattle, they've got free buses.
Well, you know what,
you can do it if you want.
My favourite positive externality. I think that's the first time I've ever heard that expression. But anyway, my favourite positive externality is less people dying on the roads. That's one of the first effects of that when they did that in London when I was living there. Mark, I mean, surely the reason that this South Bristol route is not being announced this week is mainly because it's for poor people living there, and they don't actually spend as much on transport as people in the more wealthy areas.
I'll come to that in a second. If I may just follow up what Martin said. I mean, he talked about going back into public ownership, but actually, I don't think we need to go all the way back to public ownership. If you look at the London system, it's not actually, it's still a private system, but it's under a different franchising system. That's what we want here. The London councils, well, it's the London Transport Authority, but it's effectively the mayor. They are able to decide who runs what, and they get to apportion and they get to badge loss-making routes together with profit-making routes, and that way they get to force companies to take up the loss-making routes. Now, we could, in theory, have that system here. Now, unfortunately, the new Metro Mayor is not keen on it, and neither, for some bizarre reason I can't work out, are the council leaders of the other councils around Bristol. To my surprise, I would think that the Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees, would be banging the drum for this franchising system, which we've been told under the new Metro Mayor that we can apply for.
Well, hang on,
and that
maybe
would make a difference.
Maybe he is, Vari, is he?
Well, this is what I was saying earlier about the joint bus strategy and the opportunities through there. Is that this is a debate we need to have? But obviously, I need to work.
I think
with
we've had the debate.
Other...
Let's get on with it. There's no one in the real world who doesn't think it's a good idea. The only people who don't are the bus companies, the Metro Mayor, and the Tory leader of South Gloss for some reason.
And what's the Metro Mayor's role in all this, Vari? Do you actually sit at meetings with him? Because I would hope that there's some coordination of transport, particularly.
Yeah, absolutely. So we work very closely. So with the other local authorities, I mean, the idea of the combined authority was to formalise those working relationships. And we're going through a process at the moment, developing our joint local transport plan, which is our statutory document. That's going to go out to consultation in the autumn, and also the joint bus strategy. So we're all working very closely together on this. To kind of develop what our future for transport will
look like. Surely it's a bit annoying because it's all in the wrong framework. It's not the right sort, you know, as Mark was sort of characterising it there, the wrong kind of franchising system.
I think, you know, what the comments Mark has made is, you know, some of them are fair, but this is the purpose of our transport planning policy is actually to look at these and develop them and then get them through into formal documentation. So the opportunity really in the autumn will be about actually thinking about what is our ambition and where do we want to be in 20 years.
And is Metrobus in South Bristol ever going to happen, or is it just a pipe dream?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, I'm working very closely with Karen Smith on looking at how we can deliver it.
Is there the money for it? Has anyone want to operate it?
Well, the challenges we have, like other councils across the country, is the impact of Tory austerity. And that has to be a frame, that has to be a context in which we are operating is really tight. And that's where, you know, I want to come to the defence of First Bus, actually, in the west of England. We've got James Freeman in charge of First Bus here, and he's very engaging and he's willing to work with local authorities and willing to work with us very closely on developing our bus network. The majority of buses in the city are now commercial. They require no subsidy. We have no money to subsidise bus services. And First Bus have certainly stepped up in that regard, and they have put a significant amount of investment into cleaner, better spec vehicles. So I take some of the criticism on board, but I think, you know, we've got to understand the context in which we're operating.
Well, we've got another 10 days or so to travel on it for free, folks. Just have a go. And it might be that the only way you can travel on it is for free, because you might not be able to use your Visa card if the Visa network isn't working. And also, they have what I can only describe as a diabolical app, First Group, for using the buses, which, this maybe you'd like to comment on this, Mark. It's up to you. But, I mean, I was looking at it. I was about to download it onto my phone because you can get cheaper tickets using it, but it wants to know everything. It wants to know all my contacts on my phone. It wants to be able to look at every single running application on my phone. It wants to do everything. It wants access to every file and photograph on my phone, and I'm not prepared to give First Group access to all that, so I'm not downloading their app. And by the way, if you go onto Google Play or one of these app downloading portals on your phone, you'll find hundreds of people complaining that they've tried to use the app, they can't get on the bus, they've had to buy two tickets, and all this kind of thing. So if this is going to be a ticketless revolution, it could actually turn into a total disaster.
Well, I mean, I haven't downloaded the app myself. I'm disturbed to hear that it wants to know all those kinds of things, because there's no reason for it to know it. I'm also a bit surprised, considering that the new GDPR rules have just come in, that they're still pulling stunts like that, because they know now that they can't do the kind of data mining and selling the stuff on to other people that was big in the past. If they try it,
but
all
kinds
of groups will be all over them.
And by clicking I accept, you're giving them permission to take all that data.
Yes, indeed you are. But the reason they want all that data is so that they can analyse you and then sell details about you on to other companies. But now they're not going to be able to do that very easily, and they'll get caught under the law if they try it, in the same way as, you know, Facebook is likely to in the near future because
but
of Cambridge Analytica.
I mean, if you take them to court, they'll just say, yeah, but you just clicked I accept all this.
Yeah, indeed, but you're not accepting, unless you've read the small print and it says that you're accepting resale to other companies for advertising and stuff like that, which it probably doesn't. But like I said, I haven't read that, so I don't know. So, I mean, we do have more rights since last week, which is a good thing. But yeah, I mean, I don't understand why they wouldn't know your
contacts.
Okay, here
it is. I've just got it on my phone while we were chatting away there. It wants to know my device and app history. It wants to know my identity, all my contacts, my location, all my photos, media and files. It wants use of my camera. It wants Wi-Fi connection information. It wants Bluetooth connection information.
That's so fond you have.
And device ID and call information. And I'm afraid I'm not first bus going to click accept, mate, to that. A whole load. It's just an ordinary Android phone here.
Yeah, so it's not. It's not an iPhone.
And no, it's not an iPhone. No. This is iPhone envy.
So,
here.
So
oh,
I
wish
Android
iPhone.
Tends
cabinet,
to Android then. Tends to expect. So Google phones tend to expect to have that data anyway.
Well, I don't know
so
of any
they
other
tend to track
app
your,
that's got so many requests.
So,
for,
so most Android
but
phones
then,
tend to
as
track
I say,
your location.
Look at the reviews. It scored 2. And that's the average of 2 stars, and that the even though it's had 500,000 downloads, I mean, this is just not acceptable. If we're being told we've got to use this in order to use the Metro bus anyway, so you can have a fun look.
Well,
it yourself,
actually,
Barry.
So I'm gonna look myself, but just to say, you don't need to use this actually to use the Metro bus.
For the next
we've
10
got
days.
Something called for the next 10 days. It's free. Mm-hmm. After that, you can use something called the Travel West card. So that's something that we were sort of launching. In,
hooray!
Yeah.
Okay, great.
And the Travel West card will have the same pricing as your mobile phone ticket. So it costs the same. So it's about actually getting parity. And the great thing as well is the criticism around the first touch card was not the having the availability of day tickets. The Travel West card will have the availability of day tickets as well, and you can also load it up with cash, so you don't necessarily need to have a bank account. So it helps make transport more accessible, and it's sort of the beginning as we look forward to how we advance on smart ticketing.
Look, I'm going to have a bit of fun now. A couple of reviews. Since installing this app, I've had to wait at the front of the bus for the app to load, usually started 5 minutes before boarding the bus. So people having to actually get on the bus and waiting for the app to load before they can use it. And then and someone called Will Waller is saying, I can no longer buy any tickets with this app. It forced me to pay by cash, which is more expensive, and they didn't have any change. Also, when buying tickets, all of the weird Brendan's school ones at the top put the day riders and single tickets at the top, as those are what people actually use. The other thing that people are complaining about is that when you want to actually buy a ticket using this first bus app, the buy tickets button is invisible. So the buy tickets button is actually invisible on the app, so people can't actually see where it is. But if you know it's there, you press it in the corner of your phone and that buys your ticket for
so,
you.
So I'm looking a bit confused because I've got an Apple iPhone.
Oh,
sorry.
You've got a better one.
Sorry.
Than me. Okay.
I've turned into one of these people that has an iPhone.
A lowly Android pleb.
And my app is very different, I think, from the app you have.
This is the M-Tickets app.
Yeah, it's very different from yours, and I think it's got different specifications for Apple.
Okay, so this is getting a little bit esoteric, but Martin, at the end of the day, you know, this is not good, whether it's to do with internet security or whether it's to do with, you know, not being able to use cash anymore. Because, I mean, as we've just seen today, you know, the Visa system's broken down. You can't use cash on a Metro bus.
Well, I take the point that we are where we are, and Metro bus is now operational under whatever conditions it is operational, and those who are responsible for managing it have got to manage it within the constraints of the situation. But I still come back to the point: there shouldn't have been the privatisation of bus services in the 1980s. Lots of things like that have been done wrong in this country, and one of the problems is we never put them right. We know it's wrong. We know it doesn't work. We should go back to running it by, you know, because you can actually have a proper plan. If it's all run in-house, you know exactly what you're doing and what you're subsidising, what you're not. And that was the way to do it, and that's the way we did it from the 1940s to the 1980s, and then suddenly we had a brainwave and did it wrong, and we carry on for 30 years doing it wrong, and we never go back and have another look and say, hang on, we got that wrong.
Okay.
In the 1980s. Most things went wrong in the 1980s.
Mark,
not just buses.
Do you think it's going to make a difference, Metrobus?
I think once it's up and running, which may take a while, and there's bound to be more glitches and there's bound to be more delays on the other routes, sadly. I really think that in a couple of years it will be pretty good and we'll be quite glad of it. I do think that. But, you know, I've always been a defender of Metrobus because, frankly, something is better than nothing. It has been difficult to defend it in the last year or so when the delays have been stretching ahead and, you know, one thing after another has gone wrong. But ultimately, I think that, you know, the new routes, the new dedicated sections are going to improve journey times. It's just a case, can we get to that place where it's working with no more disasters, please?
Vary, the problem with the part of the route which wasn't built properly, an inch wrong, I mean, are we going to get compensation for that? Because surely a contractor has signed a contract. I will build you a route which is going to be X number of inches or centimetres wide, and they haven't done that. So surely there's some sort of clause where the public gets its money back.
So they're going to repair that, and it was actually a few inches on the curbing. So the challenge was that because the spec of the buses, so the requirement was quite low, high spec, low emission buses, and for that route specifically was biogas buses. The buses were unintendedly longer because of the location of the gas canister. So that's why the snagging has happened, because the buses are a lot longer than what you see as a traditional bus.
The contractors built what they were told to build, but the buses changed.
And so therefore, going back to diesel buses and then sorting out the snagging issue.
You know what, I think in a way Mark has hit on one of the most important points here, and that is that when you've got an external private contractor, they don't necessarily tell you the truth. They're not necessarily honest with you about what the problems are.
I think it's more important than that. I think also having early operator involvement with any scheme. So making sure that we get operators in at the beginning and actually look at that code design and actually have early contractor involvement. And actually, there's a lot of lessons that can be learned from what's happened. And I think that can improve our processes and our approach in the future.
And a disastrous crash-free operator. Anyway, just finally, these tickets you were talking about, these new types of tickets across the city?
Travel West card.
And where can we get hold of those from?
So they'll be available in all the iPoints.
Where are they? Where are the iPoints?
So the iPoints are next to each bus stop, Metro bus stop, initially, but they'll also be available in buses and various other locations.
Okay, so we'll keep an eye on that one. It sounds like quite a good way of doing things. Also, this week we've got the problems up in Greenbank. I mean, I think it was the eviction notices were issued either last week or at the weekend to hundreds of people living in vehicles. And I just thought I'd have a chat. We're going to have to talk to some of the people who are living up there in a minute. But I thought I'd go up there yesterday and had a chat to one of the neighbours up in Greenbank, whose name is Alva.
My name is Alva. I'm a neighbour here. Lately, there's been more caravans arriving to the street. And the issue for me as a neighbour is only the rubbish. There's been rubbish left in the street, which I don't think is nice for anybody. I think the great thing would be like to arrive to some kind of agreement with the council to find a place for them to stay with the proper facilities. In the last few months I've noticed a change, yeah. So I guess not everybody is behaving the same way, but anyway, I think it's not fair for them, like, just to be kicked out.
Okay. Now a lot of people seem to have left.
Yeah. Yesterday there was double of you can see now, so yeah. I mean, I think it has had an impact, so they probably left to another place, but the problem is not disappearing in any way, not for them and not for the neighbours. They're going to be in another place, but it's going to have the same problem. They don't have facilities to use a toilet, or they don't have rubbish collection. So what it would need to be done, it would just make an agreement with the council.
Well, hundreds of people living along Greenbank View and other roads around Greenbank Cemetery. Mark, I mean, you did do housing for the City Council at one point. I mean, this started as actually quite a small park-up site, several vehicles there. It's grown and grown and grown until hundreds of people have been living there, both in living vehicles and caravans.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, my understanding is that this really started probably a couple of years ago in terms of... in terms of being a significant group of people. I mean, of course, there's always been people living in vans in streets here and there, you know, since the beginning of vans at some point or another. But it turned into a collection of people a couple of years ago. It's been growing since. It's a tough situation because these people have got, they say they can't afford anywhere to rent. I think you said a lot of them have got jobs, so they've got an income stream. They can't afford to rent, or at least they probably can't afford to rent where they really want to live, which is, you know, Eastern, Bedminster, St Werburgh's. Those are areas which historically were quite cheap areas to live, but in the last decade or so have become extremely expensive areas to live. I think perhaps one of the things people need to face up to is the fact that they can no longer live in the parts of the city that they want. I'm sure that there are parts of the city out on the estates in the suburbs that they probably could afford.
I mean, it's just a form of social cleansing going on here.
Well, that's what happens when prices go up, unfortunately. I mean, to a certain extent, Bristol has been a victim of its own success. It's now a very trendy city. It's a popular city. It's in the media all the time, nationally, you know, and even across Europe. And that when things are popular, their prices go up. That's
it's not just in Bristol this is happening, is it? It's all over the South.
No, but it's particularly
astronomical.
Bad.
Astronomical.
It's particularly
prices.
Bad in Bristol. I think Bristol's house price rises and rent rises are higher than anywhere outside London, apart from a couple of tiny little niche areas. Partly because, you know, unemployment is low here. And because it's a nice city to live, it's got friendly people, obviously, we're the best people in the world.
Well,
blah, blah.
An anonymous council spokesperson has cited in the Bristol Post a spike in complaints about loud music, drug use, public defecation and littering, saying over the last few weeks the encampment has increased to 50 vehicles parked around Greenbank Cemetery, plus a small number of tents pitched within the cemetery. We've seen a significant increase in antisocial behaviour and complaints being made to the police and the council from local residents and some of the vehicle dwellers themselves. Well, I mean, I would suggest put some bins there for them, maybe even some toilets. It was a similar sort of thing with people camping up by the M32. I mean, I'll put this to Helen Holland, you know, let's have a portaloo or something. Rather than blame the people for needing somewhere to be, let's give them a few facilities. It's not that expensive. In fact, it's probably going to cost you 10-20 times more to take them to court than it would to provide a portaloo. Anyway, let's have a listen now to a couple of the Greenbank View dwellers, David and Sam, and see what they've got to say about this whole situation, because they're, I think, probably half of the vehicles have now gone, just because obviously they don't want to be forcibly evicted by bailiffs.
I am David. How I feel is, by the way we live, we save the council hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds, because just to house me in their system costs the government how much a week to put me in sheltered accommodation? £350 a week, I believe, or something like this, yeah? That's one person. Say you got 100 people living here, yeah? How much is that going to cost the council? What's 100 people times £350? It's like £50,000 a week, yeah? So we are all saving the council £50,000 a week by living like this, and yet they are having a go at us. Okay, a few things have happened, but that's none of our involvement. That's from outsiders and other people that have got hate crimes against us, and yet we haven't got any amenities. It wouldn't cost much for the council. I've seen it on other sites where councils have put in skips, bins and toilets and haven't charged the people anything for it. I was in Lena Street by Chelsea where we had two red bins. Council provided them, took away all our waste and everything. And here I haven't seen any of that going on. The council haven't helped us at all. They've made our lives a lot harder. And like, well, the places they put you as well, people like us, and they're going to put us in like the Compass Centre or Logos House that is full of a lot of drug addicts and people that are alcoholics and violent and into all sorts of crimes, and we're not into all that. We all got businesses, work, so that's why we live down here. Unfortunately, a few people that are noisy have come down here and caused troubles for everybody and made it look bad. And
how many people have been living here roughly?
Hundreds. like on and off, hundreds of different people live there. I find it really hard living in four walls and being trapped in one place.
Well, not just that, it's quite expensive, isn't it?
It is, yeah, so it's very expensive. I can't afford it. I couldn't afford to pay electric, gas, water, TV licence, and eat, and buy myself new clothes.
I'm Sam. I feel like this is the epicentre. It's like pushed, like Bristol has been pushing sites. We're coming from a place where we've lost squatting, yeah, like not commercial buildings. We lost that a few years ago, so there's more people who are looking. They've lost that, so now it's pushing people into caravans and putting them on the sides of the road, and then they're losing these spots. And then now we've ended up with the Green Bank Cemetery where everybody's congregated, and it's made a mass problem. I've lived in the van like through my early 20s. I moved into a house. I'm living in a boat now. But like, I've been with this sort of community for the whole of my like upbringing, really. Like,
I mean, is it like, really a community? Because surely if it was a strong community, if things were going wrong, people would have been able to sort it out.
There's many communities inside.
We live in the middle of a city where there's so many people in the city. You cannot control everything, can you? You know, not even the police can. You know, and when there's that many people in the city, you know, how can we defend ourselves? Yeah, you get outsiders from nothing to do with us or anything we know, causing trouble, right?
So Green Bank, this spot here for travellers to park up, but not on the scale that they've been doing, is like great. Like, I'm a traveller. Like, this would be an amazing spot when I lived in a van. This, like, pull in here. Not with all this commotion now going on, obviously.
It has been beautiful.
It's,
you said it was beautiful here. What was the tipping point, do you think?
I think the caravan getting set on fire, to be honest. It scared everybody. Like, everybody on the road after that happened.
Was it an accident, do you know?
We don't know what happened. We really don't. Like, it's like, you know, and it's put the fear of God into everybody, to be honest. And I'm scared to go to sleep at night, because what if my van gets burnt out, you know? And, like, what could happen to anyone? What if everybody got burnt up in the fire? That would have been tragic.
Do you think this kind of way of living is coming to an end now?
No. It can't, because more people are getting pushed into this society and they don't know how to. They're like, I can't live somewhere, I've got to buy a caravan.
Is this coming to an end, this way of living?
It's going to get worse, because more people are becoming homeless and not as many people can afford rent, and this is the cheapest way of living, so it's going to become a bigger and bigger thing, because they're pushing everyone into a corner and people can't afford to pay rents and there aren't the jobs out there, and like, it's really hard for some people to get jobs, no matter how. I've tried my hardest in many walks of life. A good idea would be to have lots of small sites all around Bristol where you can have little communities, where you can have people growing vegetables, growing crops. You can have a few caravans at one place, a few caravans at other place. People with vans can go through the different sites and all that. You know what I mean? I don't think you need one massive traveller site. I think you need small sites so people can figure out themselves where they want to be and who they want to be with, and then a natural equilibrium will occur.
Yeah. Maybe like seven, eight sites around the city, so people can still be transient between areas if they need to be. Yeah, like real common ground. I don't know much about the Irish travelling community, but I know they get forced on, and they pull much bigger stunts than what any traveller would ever think. Like parking on Eastville Park, yeah, that's a bigger stunt than what we would do. But imagine if hordes of traveller people were like, actually, I'm going to park on Eastville Park. Hey, that happened last year. It happened.
Everybody now, like all us here, is the council do have an obligation to provide sites for people like us to live on around the city. Unfortunately, Bristol, there's only one site which outside of the city in Avonmouth. And unfortunately, on that site, there's a certain group of people, and these group of people aren't going to get mixing everybody all together on that one site. It's not going to work.
So where is people supposed to go then?
Well, I'm not. Yeah,
it's, where are we supposed to go? I'd like to have a little community, like dotted around the city, little different communities. One's growing veg, so I can go to each one. One way you got people doing music, so I can go there. You know, like, so you can bounce around.
Sounds like a nice plan, but
I think
the council can afford to pay millions of pounds to have all these people homed in these houses. I'm sure they can afford a few grand for a few plots of land for us to live on.
Council have derelict buildings, derelict yard space, you know, like old hospital sites before they get knocked down, before all the regulations of their completion of like ticking off, like knocking that down. That's a space for like, what, several hundred people to have a home for that duration of time, maybe. How are you going to ever change everybody to like think I'm H&M and McDonald's and I'll go and get myself a mortgage? Do we all need to fit into the same column that Social Britain wants?
That was Sam there. You had David before him. I suppose the question here, Vari, is the council has decided it doesn't want these people living there, so they're going to have to move them. They're going to be evicted. The only thing is that actually this is almost trying to get rid of the problem because there isn't anywhere nearby for them to go. So obviously more difficult for them to get to work or whatever. And this is a problem which is not going away. And this tactic of evicting everyone is not dealing with the problem.
Yeah, I mean, the first load of vans that parked there were moved to a site in Lochlea's. Obviously, more vans since then, you know, and it's become quite, you know, an extensive issue in the area. I think what was interesting was the words that the individuals were saying around it's only going to get worse. And I think it was interesting they picked up the challenge around squats because actually a lot of squats have been turned into homes, into flats, but that's pushed out the individuals that were originally living there. And it's particularly difficult if you're a single male, because if you go in the housing register, you end up...
What he was talking about was the law with regard to squatting in residential properties. Yeah. Even if the place has been empty for years, it's still...
Well, the number of empty homes is obviously going down because of the mission that our cabinet member for homes has been on to ensure that these homes are brought back into use. In terms of a site, I think this is where it's important that we do take a policy approach, that we do start thinking about how we accommodate van dwellers. There is a site obviously up at Avonmouth, which I would say is in the city.
It is in the city
and you can commute to Easton in 20 minutes. So
one of the things
they're saying
is that it's just they're just a lot of the people who are living there are not compatible with the people who are at Avonmouth, so it's not going to make a community. Anyway, Mark, what do you make of this?
They're not compatible with the people living there. That's the reality that everybody faces when they have to move in somewhere. I mean, sometimes there are people in communities that you don't like.
Yeah, I know, but when you're on site, you're actually relying on the people around you much more than if you're in a house, for example.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and if there are antisocial behaviour issues there, then I would like to see the police and the council and the council's antisocial behaviour team getting involved to try and sort that out. Because if it's the case that there are some dodgy people up there who are making it miserable for everyone, then the council needs to sort that out, and that's a fair point. But you know, we don't all get to live where we want, and we don't all get the neighbours we want. God knows we don't get the neighbours we want.
Well, what about this point that he's making about how much money they're saving the council?
Yeah, that's a reasonable point. I know that is a reasonable point, and we know
I'm
that
not sure
when
if his
people
maths was 100%. I mean, it certainly is into the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, we know
that they're saving.
When people fall out of society and end up homeless or drug addict or in some other kind of trouble, they very quickly become really, really expensive to the council, and we know that it's better financially to prevent that and to try and deal with them before that's happening. And I think, you know, there has to be some compromise on both sides here. I think, first of all, the council does need to look at sites. It needs to, you know, it needs to sort out the Avonmouth situation. But also, people need to understand that you can't just, you know, nobody gets to live where they want unless you're a millionaire these days. The reality
is... I think many of these people don't want to live in a caravan, don't want to live, and they're forced into that situation.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, in terms of, you know, in terms of the area of the city that they're wanting to live in, I think it's, you know, it's reasonable. Sometimes you've got to compromise and you've got to live somewhere, at least for a few years, that isn't ideal, but you hope to move somewhere better when you do a bit
better.
Okay,
we're going to have a look at the very, I found, fascinating point that David made about St Mungo's and how, for many people, the council are offering them some form of accommodation which simply isn't suitable because there's too many drugs and too much drugs drugs and alcohol flying around, and they just want to get away from that world. And on that subject, last week I went to the Universal Credit demo down near Temple Meads, organised by Unite the Union and PCS, the two trade unions, where I met this chap who... he is anonymous, and he's a migrant from Afghanistan, and he is actually a monk, a St. Mungo's resident who was finding it extremely difficult.
Originally, I'm from Afghanistan. I came a long time ago as a refugee. The council just put me in a hostel. There's so much like drugs and alcohol involved. The charity is run by St. Mungo's. The hostel is in St. George in Bristol. I always tried to get away from drugs and alcohol. They take anything, crack, heroin. I seen people, they are suffering. They got a serious mental issue, and still they put them over there, you know. They're not going to get any better, to be honest, you know. Just they need help. And I see quite a few people, and they committed suicide, and they took their life away. As in a human being, you know, just we need help. We need be supported one each other, you know, one another. It's getting tough and harder, you know. As a human being, as a human right, it doesn't matter I'm from Afghanistan, you know, or I'm from England. Each one of us, we got the right as a human being. We do need help.
Well, Fari, what he's saying there is that the places where the council are housing people are simply not safe environments. And obviously, a lot of these are very vulnerable people. You've got two main problems, mental illness and drugs, hard drugs. We're talking about crack and heroin. I mean, people don't really want that and don't need that around them, where place they're living.
And cuts to our mental health service, you know, the pressure the NHS is under, cuts to alcohol abuse and drug abuse services. It's a spiralling issue, and it's really important that we take a holistic approach. We see these people as people, and that they do need that support.
But so why is it that this is tolerated, this kind of drug use and alcohol use in sheltered accommodation like that?
I think it's important to take a home first approach. So providing shelter for these individuals is really important. Otherwise, they end up on the street, and we end up with various other issues. I mean, the number of individuals that have died, rough sleeping. I mean, that's something that we need to make sure that they've at least got somewhere that they can.
Why isn't there sheltered housing that is safe?
There is, absolutely.
Well, he's saying that there isn't. Anyway, Mark, what do you make of this problem?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tragedy that's unfolding here. I mean, what he's talking about is the collision of two different types of destitute people. I mean, refugees arrive in this country destitute, and homeless people, and who have nearly always been through some kind of addiction, which is why they end up ultimately homeless, and they end up destitute. And they're actually, although they're both two groups of destitute people, they're very different, and very different actually in their needs. And refugees are obviously quite shocked to come face to face with the kind of homeless addiction problems that we've got in this country for British citizens. I feel sorry for the poor guy. It's unfortunate that he's sort of still in that kind of situation after a number of years.
But it's not getting better, it's getting worse, isn't it? With universal credit, people are afraid to take a job now, because they know if they take a job and if they get sacked, that means that they're probably going to get evicted as well.
Yeah, I mean, Vary's right to raise the point about the brutal cuts against local government services, drug addiction services and rehousing services. We're a long way out of the recession that we had nearly 8 years ago now. The deficit is down to less than a third of what it was when the coalition took over. I would say we don't need to be cutting local government services like this anymore, and the government needs to give some more money.
Okay, the sooner the better. Well, time for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Thanks to our guests, Cabinet Member for Transport, Connectivity, that's Labour Councillor for Eastville, Vary Threlfall, also Lib Dem Councillor for, what was it?
Howells and Harborside.
Sorry about that, Mark Wright. Join us after the news. We do our best to keep ahead of the curve.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.